You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. For some Madison High School students, getting every question wrong or failing to turn in homework assignments won't result in a zero, but a 40%. We'll look at the thinking behind so-called grading floors in schools coming up. Now the number of fatal officer-involved shootings is up in the state this year, with a total of 16 to date in 2019. That's three more than the total last year. Experts who study the issue say there's no one cause for an increase in police shootings, but there are some common factors. Rob Mentzer is WPR's rural communities reporter based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, can you add some context to these numbers? Does this seem like a big increase as you talk to experts?
So it's not a big increase, and it's not clear that whether what we're looking at is a trend. It is now it's significant. There have been five people shot and killed by police in the last 5 weeks in Wisconsin. We are at 16 fatal police shootings this year. There were 13 last year in Wisconsin. Now the year before that there were 24. 2017 appears to have been a bit of an outlier based on the years in which the data has been kept. That was the highest. So we can't say for sure, but it is significant. Sometimes these things happen in they're unrelated incidents, but sometimes just by random distribution, they can happen in clusters, and we have had a cluster in Wisconsin recently.
Yeah, along those lines, you talked to Jim Palmer, head of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association, about these numbers. Let's give a little listen to what he had to say.
There are these pockets where it occurs from time to time, where there are these kind of concerning spikes, and there really doesn't appear to be any rhyme nor reason to them.
And Rob, in your reporting, you talk about a couple of the shootings. Can you give us an example of situations that have ended in a police a fatal shooting by police?
Well, so these, you know, it's important to say these vary widely, right? Mm-hmm. There are a lot of different types of circumstances that can cause, and the great majority of these cases in Wisconsin involved a suspect who was armed. There have been several cases where a suspect was shot during a shootout after shooting at police himself. That's a scenario. There are also chases. Most recently in Wisconsin, on November 19th in Kewaunee County, police shot and killed a man, a 38-year-old man who had abducted and had shot a woman that he'd been in a relationship with. His victim survived. She's recovering. But then police caught up with this suspect, and he was shot and killed in that confrontation.
Talking to WPR reporter Rob Mentzer. He's based in Wausau. We're looking at the number of police-involved shootings in Wisconsin this year. You talked, Rob, to a researcher, John Roman, from the University of Chicago. He talked about the idea of de-escalation training in police departments.
Law enforcement agencies that implement aggressive, intentional de-escalation training and policies shoot far less often than law enforcement agencies that don't.
Can you talk about this idea of de-escalation training, Rob?
So this is about what it sounds like. It is training that is aimed at promoting alternatives to violence. Now, if there's an active shootout happening, that may not be an option for police. But in other instances, there are a lot of these cases. A common thread here, not in every case, but in many cases, are individuals who are in the throes of some sort of mental health crisis. That is something that you see again and again. And in some cases, a fatal police shooting call originated with a report that someone was making suicidal comments. That's why the police reported there in the first place. And it escalated into violence and use of lethal force by police. Now, that may not be unlawful. No police officer has been charged in Wisconsin this year for breaking the law and using force in these ways. But it does raise the question of whether there are options to keep the confrontation, the situation, from reaching the point of violence. And de-escalation training is all about encouraging that. Wisconsin, there are departments in Wisconsin that require it. There are many police officers in Wisconsin who have gone through this type of training, but it's not required, and not every department does it. So that is an area that to the extent this is a concern or a public concern, that is something that seems to have an impact, make a difference in these numbers.
You mentioned that many of the people who were involved in these police-involved shootings were armed. You looked into gun ownership rates and how that correlates, if at all, with police shootings. What did you see in our last few moments?
Yeah, this is an area of John Roman's research. And one thing that he found was that there's a clear correlation between state gun ownership rates and police shootings in that state. States that have higher gun ownership rates have higher rates of police killing residents. And his way of thinking about this or explaining this is, you know, if an officer is working in a place where they are likely to encounter a civilian who has a gun, that officer may be more on edge, maybe more objectively more at risk than in a place where there are fewer firearms owned by civilians, right? Now, Wisconsin has, of course, a gun culture. We all know it. It's a hunting season now. But Wisconsin is not among the most heavily armed states. Most of the data on this is that Wisconsin is somewhere towards the bottom third of states for per capita guns.
And we'll leave it there. Rob, thanks for joining us. That was Rob Mentzer, Rural Communities reporter for WPR, with us today to talk about a rise in the number of officer-involved shootings in Wisconsin this year. Stick around. More to come here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the popular toy doll Barbie always came with a trendy outfit, and that wasn't by accident. We'll talk with a longtime fashion designer for Barbie about what it takes to design big looks for a small doll. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a look at the history of Wisconsin's name.
We recently received a flurry of questions through the Wisconsin Project from the fourth grade class at Mineral Point Elementary School. Most of the questions were about the state of Wisconsin. Questions like, how did Wisconsin get all of its cows? And who invented the state dog? We sent WPR's Mary Kate McCoy to investigate.
When I saw these questions come in, I got really excited. It's because I'm from Mineral Point, and one question in particular stood out to me, from Josie Dunn. Because, full disclosure, I've known Josie for a long time.
Josie, we know each other, don't we?
Yeah.
How do we know each other?
You were my old babysitter.
Mm-hmm. We had some fun, didn't
mm-hmm.
we? You wrote a question to Wisconsin, mm-hmm. and what was your question?
How did Wisconsin get its name?
And why do you want to know the answer to that?
Because Wisconsin's a really unique name for a state, and I just really wanted to know why it was mainly called Wisconsin.
And what do you think the answer is?
Maybe the person who, like, lived in the state didn't really have a name yet, maybe made Wisconsin a state and named it after him.
And are you excited to find out the answer?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it turns out that's a somewhat tricky question to answer. But what we do know is that it came from the Algonquian language family, spoken by Wisconsin tribes like the Menominee, Ojibwe, Potawatomi, and Mohican. And it certainly was not pronounced Wisconsin.
I was always told it was Wiscosec, and some people have said Wiscosin. There's a Wiscosec, a Wiscosec.
Napus is an elder in residence at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, a member of the Menominee tribe.
To translate that would be basically the first part comes from the word reshkiu, which means something good, and that ending is more, what you would say, locative. Then you would say a good place to, like, camp or to make a clearing or to basically live.
Rand Valentine is a University of Wisconsin-Madison Linguistics and American Studies professor. He offers another interpretation.
The word Wisconsin originates from an Algonquian language word, meskusing. And Meskwesing is probably Miami, Illinois language, but possibly Ojibwe. It's a little bit uncertain. And the word translates as where it lies red. And the best guess is that's making reference to the red cliffs around the Dells.
But once the French got a hold of the word, Napus says its pronunciation started to change.
The big confusion, though, was when the French came in. A lot of those names were mistranslated because basically they couldn't pronounce them.
Many scholars trace a European adoption of the name Wisconsin to the missionary and explorer Father Jacques Marquette. Valentine says the change came after he traveled across Wisconsin from Green Bay to the Mississippi River with fur trader Louis Joliet and two Miami Indians as guides.
He recorded this word as their word for the Wisconsin River. They themselves were refugees here in Wisconsin. There was lots of turmoil in the 17th century.
So then where did the W come from? Valentine says that came from a simple misreading of the text.
There was a famous mapmaker, and he showed the name to LaSalle, who mistook the first two letters, which were just this very flamboyant M, as O-I, which he interpreted as we.
Over time, as more English speakers settled into the area, the French spelling was changed to the more English W. Napus and Valentine agree that knowing where the name comes from is powerful.
If you're a language speaker, you should know what that means by breaking it down. And that's the importance of language, because if you don't have that quality, then you're just reciting.
When we recognize that this state's very name comes from one of the languages of the country's first people, it will perhaps give us a greater appreciation for their place, not just in the past, but in the present.
WPR's Mary Kate McCoy brought us this story. And Josie's question came to us through the Wisconsin Project. Submit your own questions and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, toy company Mattel was the third largest manufacturer of clothing during the 60s and 70s, thanks to Barbie. Barbie is iconic, and for many, it's the clothes that really completed her. Our next guest is responsible for many of Barbie's outfits. She designed looks for Malibu Barbie, a jumpsuit outfit that appeared on Barbie when she was on the Dean Martin show, and even the clothes Barbie wears in the Toy Story movies. Carol Spencer worked for Mattel as a fashion designer for Barbie beginning in 1963. She created thousands of designs for the iconic doll. Her new book is called Dressing Barbie, a celebration of the clothes that made America's favorite doll and the incredible woman behind them. Carol, welcome to Central Time.
Well, it's my pleasure to be asked to join you.
Now, you grew up in the Midwest. You ended up as a fashion designer in Milwaukee. What brought you to that job here in Wisconsin?
Well, the fashion industry was moving out of Minneapolis, Minnesota, which is where I actually grew up. And there was an advertisement in the paper that sounded appealing. It was for Junior House of Milwaukee. Anyway, I worked there for a year, sort of transitioning to California. But, you know, I found that the weather was much colder in Milwaukee than Minneapolis, I'm sorry to say. I lived right on Lake Michigan, and it was a very damp cold.
So you ended up in a warmer place, California, and you fell in love with Barbie before you worked there, and especially there. What was it about Barbie that really grabbed you as a designer?
Well, Barbie was introduced as a teenage fashion model, and I was designing fashions. And, you know, she had such wonderful popularity that I thought it'd be fun to really try my hand at it. And once I got the job, I found out that I loved it, and I stayed for well over 35 years.
You'd think working at a toy company would be all fun and laughs, but I understand when you started there, this was a very high security environment. They were very worried about people stealing the new ideas that were coming out of Barbie, right?
Oh, that's right, because, you know, many of the people there came directly out of aerospace. And so we had all of the government aerospace security, which was interesting. But we had a lot of competitors because, you know, when a toy is a hit, then everybody wants to get in on it. And so that was our high security.
What are the challenges of being a clothing designer for a model that's under a foot tall? What is different in designing for a doll instead of a person?
Actually, I found that it was a lot easier. Everything was on a smaller scale, and, you know, it could fit on my desk. I didn't have to stand up to do things. You know, as a designer, I was trained not to be just a fashion illustrator, drawing a pretty picture of what I thought I would like and having someone else execute it. I learned all the fundamentals of draping, drafting, actually letting the fabric talk to me in order to create the design on the figure. And so in that regard, you know, it was wonderful working with Barbie.
In your book, you talk about a pair of boots you had. I think this was in the 60s, some white high boots with cutouts, and you made a version of those for one of Barbie's looks. Did you draw a lot of inspiration from your own closet?
In some cases, yes. Those boots I absolutely loved. In fact, I still have them. I guess I'm a pack rat, but I keep the things that I dearly love. Barbie was not really ahead of fashion. We were trained to offer fashion to a child that was understandable to them. And you have to realize that back in the 1960s, we did not have instant fashion changing before our eyes through television, Instagram, all the other mediums that we have today. There was a fashion curve where a certain trend started, and then it became popular. And it was at that point that we aimed to hit the market. So it was an interesting way of designing. Today, of course, it's a real challenge for people to design. They have to come up with something totally different. It's a struggle now with all this instant technology.
We're talking to Carol Spencer. Her new book is called Dressing Barbie, about her career at Mattel, designing clothes over the decades for Barbie. Carol, it's come full circle. I understand some fashion designers, modern fashion designers, have come up to you and said they were inspired by some of the work you did on Barbie.
Yes. As a matter of fact, a very well-known Paris designer, I think it was back in about 1970, and that was Yves Saint Laurent. And we were attending a Fashion Group Incorporated luncheon where he was displaying his Mondrian collection. And afterwards, I went up to him and I asked him for his autograph. And he said, "What do you do?" And I said, "I'm a Barbie designer." And that was when he told us that he looked at the Barbie line every year to see what we were doing.
Wow.
So that was really interesting and kind of fun. It's something I've never forgotten.
You write that the Barbie model was kind of frugal over the years, and that was really important, strangely, in the oil embargo in the 1970s. All of a sudden, transportation costs went up. The costs of polyester went up. How did that change what you were drawing and then making for Barbie?
Fashion changed quite a bit because we could not use petroleum-based products. The materials, such as polyester, some of the knits, the acrylic knits are petroleum-based. Today, spandex is petroleum-based. You know, there's any number of things. So we actually went to a very natural type of fiber, which is the trend, I believe, today that fashion is trying to go natural.
You, even after you retired, I understand you stay in touch with the Barbie community, including people who collect Barbies. What's it like being in touch with people who are so connected to the work you did over the years?
Oh, it's absolutely wonderful. They have become some of my very best friends. In fact, two of them are coming to my house for Thanksgiving dinner, if you can believe it. So, you know, it was just natural that I should develop friendships with them. And I really love going to the conventions. They're lots of fun.
You have one Barbie in your collection that I'm guessing none of those other collectors have. When you were retired, you were given, I think I have this right, a Carol Spencer Barbie.
Yes, I was given a Barbie doll that replicated my look. I still have the suit, but I certainly can't get into it anymore. That was, what, 20 years ago, something like that. And anyway, I have the suit, and they replicated my hairstyle and all that. And they put it on the doll that I was trying to develop when we were trying to see if we wanted to stay with porcelain dolls. And so this was a porcelain doll that was actually a one of a kind that we were trying to make more natural so that people would enjoy that. But then what Mattel ended up doing was coming out with the Silkstone doll that replaced the porcelain.
And you still have that? You're a pack rat. You must still have that in your collection?
Oh, I have. My house is full of Barbie dolls. Yes, I do still have it in my collection. And I love every one of them. And many of them are in my dining room. I have a huge curio cabinet full, and I have another cabinet on the wall. So when you eat at my house, you're never alone. You're always enjoying the company of Barbie.
That's fantastic, Carol. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, it's been my pleasure.
Carol Spencer worked for Mattel as a fashion designer for Barbie beginning in 1963. She created thousands of designs for the iconic doll. Her new book is called Dressing Barbie, a celebration of the clothes that made America's favorite doll and the incredible woman behind them. Are you one of the Barbie collectors we were talking about? Are you a longtime Barbie fan? Let us know. Email now at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. Coming up, we'll talk with a Madison High School principal about new grading practices aimed at keeping freshmen on track to graduate. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent and her guest look at the latest efforts to prevent and treat HIV here in Wisconsin. It's tomorrow morning at 7:15 on The Morning Show. Now, some changes are coming to the way some students at Madison West High School are graded. For one thing, no more zeros. Instead, in many cases, the lowest grade you could get is a 40%, even if you get everything wrong. It's known as a grade floor. It's going to apply to freshmen in West's core classes, so English, math, science, social studies, that kind of thing. Also, if you turn in work late, teachers can give you a grade of up to 90%. This has happened in other schools around the country. Supporters say it helps students keep on track to graduate. Critics say they could hurt students in the long run. Karen Boran joins us. She's the principal at Madison West High School. Karen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Before we get into how exactly this works, can you talk about the motivation? What are you trying to accomplish with this change?
Sure. The transition from eighth grade to ninth grade is probably the most significant transition a kid has in their academic career. And in some cases, attendance goes down and GPA goes down. And since the research that's coming out shows that GPA is twice as effective a predictor of a student's ability to be successful in college and graduate on time than test scores, we really want to look at what can we do to increase students' GPA during their ninth grade year so that they remain on track to graduate in 4 years.
So talk about a little of the math here. What happens to that student who might get a zero, say, on that big assignment in these core classes?
Sure. So what we're trying to do is prevent the super F. And so, Rob, let's say you had a bad day.
It happens.
You'd had a bad day and you bombed a test. If that test is a test where what we call a summative test, a unit assessment, something that's got big points attached to it, and you bomb it, The grading scale in many places right now is a 100-point scale. Now, that means that anything below a 60 is failing. You get 10 points to get an A, 10 points to get a B, but you have 60 points for an F. So if you're trying to recoup and you get a super F, it makes it extraordinarily difficult. Now, the thinking behind this change, and again, we're piloting just in our ninth grade teams this year, just as is happening in other schools in the district. The thinking behind the 100-point grading scale is that in the late 19th century, this was a device that was used when 50% was the passing rate. Right now, it's about 75. So it's a construct from the 19th century that somebody invented. In other schools, they might use a 5-point grading scale or a 20-point grading scale. So the fact of a 100-point is something that you know, we can look at and decide whether or not that really provides the best opportunity for every kid to demonstrate mastery of content, skills, and standards. Sometimes it's such a demotivator that kids just lose all hope in being able to you know, come back from it.
Right. You can see a scenario where a kid comes into high school. It's this crazy new setting. The standards are different. The class schedule's different. Yep. Their first couple few tests, they bomb. And then they're basically mathematically eliminated potentially from an A or maybe even a passing grade.
That's right. Now, there are some concerns about this that perhaps, you know, this will lead to grade inflation. Mm-hmm. The University of Chicago's Consortium for Chicago School Research did a study on that and did not find grade inflation. They found that while this practice was going on in those schools, they saw a commensurate rise in student achievement with respect to graduation rate and test scores, as well as GPA. Another concern is that it doesn't. We are not holding everyone to the same level of rigor. Mm-hmm. And Rob, one of the things I want to say about that true rigor is high standards for everyone, and then the kind of supports that allow the individual to really reach those standards. And so what we're really trying to do is provide true rigor for all kids so that all kids can demonstrate mastery of the skills and content that teachers are aiming towards.
Another part of this plan, as I understand it, involves late homework assignments and kind of having a standardized measurement for what students can get if they come back and turn it in late. What happens there?
Sure. So what we are piloting in our ninth grade core teams, now remember, we've been working together on these conversations. This is the third year. So it's still evolving, and we're not, the teams are making the decision as to what gets implemented and what gets piloted. So we're trying to bring this from the ground up. But let's say you have some late work. We would rather you did the actual homework and turn it in late than ask the teacher for extra credit and get credit for doing a crossword puzzle or something non-related. Just do the practice work. The 90% is to provide a motivator for the kid to actually turn in the work. And of course, there's a challenge with kids holding on to all the work and then turning it in right before the test. These are 14-year-olds, so let's just remember that that's a possibility. But we would rather that they did the work and get the points than not do anything at all.
Are there other features of this plan you want to point out?
Sure. The fact that the goal is really to come to consensus as to what our teachers are doing at any particular grade level. Our students move through 7 classes a day. And when teachers have different grading scales, different expectations, different late policy, different retake policies, it's very confusing for kids. So what we want to do is just provide consistency so the kid can understand what the rules are, which increases their motivation to go the extra mile and make up the work and do what they can to really improve their achievement.
And Karen, before we let you go, I know it's still early days. This is still an evolving process, but anecdotally, have you seen this making a difference for those incoming freshman students?
We have. We're seeing a reduction in failure rates in our core ninth grade classes. It's still not enough. Our white kids last year, our white 15-year-old students were 97.3% on track to graduate. Our African-American students were 48.5%. We have a long way to go. Obviously, no shortage of intellectual capacity with the African-American kids. So we have to figure this out.
Karen, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Karen Brand is the principal at Madison West High School. They're trying out different grading practices for freshmen. They include giving scores no lower than a 40%, allowing a grade of up to 90% for work turned in late, and as we heard, getting rid of extra credit. Now we bring in Peter Goff from UW-Madison, an assistant professor of educational leadership and policy analysis. His areas of expertise include K-12 educational policy. Peter, welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thanks, Rob.
What do you think of this idea and what you're hearing, not just from Madison West, but other schools trying this grading floor?
I think the grading floor has a lot of potential, as Karen mentioned, to help narrow that achievement gap, particularly for the students that have faced the most adversity. So as you mentioned, some of these scenarios, we think about who is this policy benefiting? And it's not so much that if these are students getting 70s, 80s, 90s, it's not students that are impacted by this particular policy. This might be the student that their parents are going through a divorce, their pet died, right? They have something's going on in their life, intermittent or chronic homelessness, right? They're just dealing with things that the other students aren't, and it, you know, those super Fs put them behind the ball sufficiently that they lose the motivation to move forward. So policies like this, I think, are helpful in keeping the students engaged and moving forward.
And Karen mentioned some people raised the concern that are we just lowering standards here for students? Do you have a concern about that?
Not explicitly. There is something to be said for Karen mentioned the long history of the 100-point grading scale. And so a lot of what we're doing now, we use that scale, but we don't particularly use it for the right reasons. So if we think about our ability to really distinguish, how is a kid that gets a 64, which might be failing, and a 66, how are they really different in terms of their knowledge, and how confident are we in that fine-grained of an assessment? So moving to something that's more like a 5-point scale where we have clearly defined standards and we know what the students know, I think is much more in keeping with what we want grading to be rather than just an opportunity to sort kids into different buckets.
It seems like with assessing a whole year's worth of work from a kid, even if we want a really truly objective standard, that may be easier said than done?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the idea that we can put a number or a letter on a student and have that convey meaning, you got a C in algebra. What does that actually mean? You know, what knowledge do you have? What knowledge are you lacking? What skills can you bring forward that your next year's teacher is going to be able to build on? These are really difficult tasks. So when we think about moving towards a more standards-based grading, where we really identify standard by standard if a student does have mastery or does not have mastery, that can be really helpful.
All right, this is a huge question. Is there, in your view, a right way or the closest to best way to do this?
I think keeping learning in the forefront. So we say thinking about how are we using grades? What are they good for, right? On one hand, as Karen mentioned, that a lot of the high schools work in collaborative teams. So being able to have teachers talk to other teachers about what's being learned, specifically what's being learned. What are the tasks that the students have mastered? What are the tasks that they're struggling with? If one teacher is able to, you know, their students are really excelling in a particular area, these sort of standardized assessments in grading by standard can really facilitate those conversations and help improve instruction. And it also, at the student level, helps convey what the students do know, what they don't know, and where we can give them supports to build their knowledge base.
We're talking about some new grading practices in classes at Madison High Schools and elsewhere around the country. Peter Goff is with us, assistant professor of educational leadership and policy analysis at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this idea of grading floors that we heard about, a 40% minimum grade on, say, that big test? Do you have concerns about how this might work? If you are teaching in schools, what do you see as being the key for that first-year high school student, say, who's struggling early on, how do you keep them in the game and motivated to learn, even if it looks like they're flunking right from the outset? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our discussion with Peter Goff of UW-Madison. He's an assistant professor of educational leadership and policy analysis. We're talking about the idea of a grading floor in some schools around the country, including this year some schools in Wisconsin. The idea is to get rid of 0% grades that can be hard to bounce back from on, say, that big test or those big homework assignments. What do you think? Good idea? Bad idea? Call in at 800-642-1234. Is this something you'd like to see implemented in your kids' schools? Is this helpful or harmful to students? If you're a teacher, how do you think this would affect your classroom? If you had trouble, say, in your first year of high school, what would have helped you get through it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll bring on a caller now. Harry is with us in Madison. Harry, hi.
Hey, how are you? Hey, one point. So I'm on a scholarship foundation, and we see a lot of kids coming out of school, and I don't know if they're truly prepared for college. I mean, not that high school isn't hard, but I don't know if a lot of high school kids really have to put in a lot of time and effort to get good grades versus going to college, because I'm guessing that first semester in college is probably one of the hardest semesters that kids have.
Harry, thanks for the call. Peter, can you connect the dots from that freshman year of high school to being ready for that freshman year in college if a student goes to college?
Sure. I think a lot of the same challenges arise coming out of a middle school into a high school. The organizational structure changes. The rigor definitely changes. And in that freshman year of college is just as important as that freshman year of high school to make that matriculation through the program. Harry, I think you're right. We do face a lot of challenges with the preparedness of students coming out of high school. I think we've removed a lot of roadblocks that have helped students graduate. So we've been able to improve graduation rates without just, you know, pushing people through. But there's still a lot of colleges struggle with the remediation programs that they have to deploy to make up for the skills that students aren't learning in high school.
Thanks a lot for that call, Harry. And Peter, you talked about, you know, making sure grades or whatever the rating system is support the learning. Do we have a system in many cases where the grades are the kind of the end and end all and be all of themselves, and then we do the learning to meet the grades or the assessments or the test or whatever it might be?
I think that's definitely a mentality in a lot of schools and for a lot of students. So the idea of using grades for the right thing is a cultural shift amongst faculty as well as among students to get people understanding that these are, it's communication, right? This is communication to the student, it's communication to other teachers, it's communication to the parents. And the more information that a grade can convey, the better that communication is going to be.
Let's bring on another caller now. Tyler is with us in Green Bay. Tyler, hi.
Hi. I'm calling because I work with a lot of students who education isn't necessarily their biggest priority, because a lot of them are worried about what they're going to eat or if they're safe when they go home. And so developing those relationships with students really gets them ready to learn because they feel safe in the classroom, and that's where I see a lot of success happening.
Tyler, thanks for the call. What do you think, Peter?
He's absolutely correct. There's a pretty well-known book from Nell Noddings out of Stanford. That's the main quote is that students have to know that you care before they can care about the learning. And I think that's exactly what Tyler is getting at. And this is particularly true for a lot of the students are less affluent students that are coming to school for a lot more than just the academics that are provided.
Thanks for that call, Tyler. Okay, but if I'm an educational policymaker at the federal level or the state level, you can give me numbers showing the grades or the SAT scores or whatever the evaluation is. It's very hard for me to quantify relationship building.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's I don't know that can be quantified, or even that we should be trying to quantify it. But we talk to a lot of students about the role of particular teachers in their lives and kind of shaping their path forward and inspiring them through adversity, which is, you know, related to the grading floor conversation.
Let's go back to our callers. Patrice is with us in Azathlon. Patrice, hi.
Hi. So working with kids not in schools but outside and
they tell me that they are not allowed to get ones and twos, so that teachers will work with them so that they can get a three just to do the bare minimum, just to get by. And they kind of joke about it because they're really not there to learn the content. They're just going through the motions. It's like they're playing school.
Patrice, thanks for the call. So Patrice's concern is if we don't let kids fail, there's no motivation for them to avoid falling short in school.
Yeah, that can definitely be a concern. I taught previously in Chicago, and that they offered summer remediation classes, and there were students that checked out, and they knew that the summer classes were easier, they had less rigor, so they said they'd basically just go through the motions during the school year so that they could take these makeup classes over the summer. So I think we have to be true to the system that we have. If we allow students to game the system, then that's what's going to happen, and I think we have to be okay letting kids fail, and at the same time knowing that we're providing them all the supports possible to ensure their success.
Thanks for the call, Patrice. We're talking to Peter Goff from UW-Madison, looking at experiments, including some Wisconsin schools, with the way students are graded, a grading floor, a big part of that, saying no, a total failure isn't 0%, it's 40%, and kind of changing the motivations for students, trying to keep them in the game in their freshman year. Back to your calls now. Kevin is with us in Janesville. Kevin, hi.
Hi. I'm a teacher. I've taught private school, public school. I've been on both sides of these great safety nets. But the big failure right now with education is we're still expecting all kids to learn the same thing at the same time, in the same time frame, and it just doesn't happen. Some kids just aren't ready for certain concepts. It's brain development. It's relationships, as the previous caller said, and the stuff that really counts is just not measurable.
Kevin, thanks for the call. Peter, what do you think?
Kevin, I think you're absolutely correct. When we think about one of the benefits of standards-based grading, that gets exactly to the heart of what you're talking about. When we think about individualized instruction and students working on a particular standard can work on that standard at their own developmental pace until they have mastered that. And different students might progress through at different times. But if we use a standard-based approach, then we can meet students where they are and provide supports for where they are and help that they make sure that they master the material at their own pace. And I think that's exactly where the relationships are built. When the teacher is working with individual students in a classroom setting, but still working with individual students to build that rapport and trust.
Thanks for that call. Peter, in our last minute or so, bringing things back to our conversation with Karen Boren, we heard about these ideas, the grading floor, late homework, allowing that to count more, these efforts to keep freshmen in. Are these game changers? Are they tinkering around the edges? Do we need more fundamental change?
We do need more fundamental change, and this is tinkering around the edges, but it's an important tinkering. I think it represents something important. As Karen mentioned, we're focusing on the most vulnerable students, and we're making sure that the organizational system in which these students are operating doesn't hold them to an unreasonable standard, doesn't stack the deck against them for these sort of catastrophic mistakes. It's the same reason why we have insurance day to day, right? To protect us against these unforeseen, really unfortunate events.
Peter, thanks a lot for joining us in the studio today.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Peter Goff, Assistant Professor of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at UW-Madison. We talked to them about new grading practices being tried out at Madison high schools and elsewhere around the country. They include giving minimum classroom grades of 40%, getting rid of extra credit, and allowing a grade of up to 90% for homework that's turned in late. Earlier, we talked with Madison West High School Principal Karen Boran. Madison West is implementing these changes for freshmen in English, math, science, social studies, and gym classes. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a Google project has collected a lot of personal health data from millions of people around the country. It looks legal, but it has a lot of people worried. We'll find out what's going on and why the federal government has opened an investigation. We have a lot of ways to measure public opinion on political issues, but should that influence the actions of elected officials? We'll take a look at polling and policy. And it's a big travel season, so it's a good time to share the rules of etiquette for airline passengers, including those reclining seats that are so controversial. You can share your stories from planes and trains and buses, too. That and look at the news of the day. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6, if you're still firming up your plans for Thanksgiving dinner or you're looking ahead to other holiday cooking, Kate's guest has advice for you. Join the conversation with your holiday cooking questions and advice. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. And then from citizenship to voting rights, U.S. politics today were shaped by constitutional amendments at the end of the Civil War. A historian tells us why we experienced a second founding of the United States. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.